Yes, I yell a phone, what more? Could you want from life, what more? Could you be living?
Sasha.
And this is Eli,
and you're listening to
WGXC
Acra.
Tune in or turn out Saturday, October 23rd to John Cage's Rozart Mix, realized by artist Aaron Dillaway at Bard College in Annandale-on-Hudson. The performance will be at the John Cage Trust from noon to sunset with collaborating tape players including Twig Harper from Nautical Almanac, Rosie Actor Engel, John Weiss, Mike Colino, and C. Lavender. John Cage's Rozart Mix was composed in 1965 for a performance at Brandeis University's Rose Art Gallery. The score is correspondence between John Cage and Alvin Lucier concerning preparations for the concert utilizing tape loops. Aaron Dillaway, who's known for his work in Wolf Eyes and many other collaborations, was a former Wave Farm resident who worked with tape loops and cart machines in his residency in Accra.
Anyone attending this event must show proof of vaccination and register to make an appointment to be scheduled to see the show.
You can find out more about the Saturday, October 23rd performance of John Cage's Rozart Mix, realized by artist Aaron Dillaway, in the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Greenville Drive-In 32, a destination for movies and music under the stars of the Northern Catskills since 1959. Seasonal programming information at drivein32.com or 518-966-2177.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Food New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Who is community radio for?
It's for people.
You mean it's for the people?
What's the difference between people and the people?
People you see on the street are people. You can see them. You can't see the people. There's too many to see.
You can't see anything on the radio anyway.
That's what's great about radio. There's nothing to see.
That means you can drive at the same time you listen to the radio.
Do you think it's safe to operate a motor vehicle while listening to WGXC?
Is it safe to use power tools while listening to WGXC?
90.7 FM. WGXC.
Hi, this is Kenny Kramer, the real Kramer, and you're listening to WGXC Acra. And as Cosmo would say, giddy up.
You've tuned into All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network, network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood.
WGXE underwriting is provided in part by Kravitz and Son Roofing, a local family-owned and operated full-service roofing company for more than 48 years. Specializing in residential and commercial roof construction, repair, maintenance, and replacement, using high-quality and affordable roofing products. Information at 518-567-4026 or online at KravitzandSonRoofing.com.
WGXE is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Christina Bonesack of Germantown, New York. WGXE's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXE as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXE sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXE.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXE newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. CBS News reports that President Joe Biden announced September 9th a vaccine mandate for all federal workers and contractors and a requirement that large companies mandate vaccines or regular testing for employees. It comes as the country faces mounting coronavirus case numbers and many more deaths. Biden spoke from the White House.
Even as the Delta variant COVID-19 has been hitting this country hard, we have the tools to combat the virus. If we can come together as a country and use those tools, if we raise our vaccination rate, protect ourselves and others with masking, expanded testing, and identify people who are infected, we can and we will turn the tide on COVID-19.
The Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration is developing rules requiring employers with at least 100 employees to have a fully vaccinated workforce or require unvaccinated workers to get tested for COVID-19 at least once a week, with fines of $14,000 per violation. The Republican National Committee announced plans to file a lawsuit against the Biden administration over the issue. RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel said, and I quote, "I'm pro-vaccine and anti-mandate. Many small businesses and workers do not have the money or legal resources to fight Biden's unconstitutional actions and authoritarian decrees. But when his decree goes into effect, the RNC will sue the administration to protect Americans and their liberties," end quote. The American Federation of Government Employees Union did not endorse the plan, saying they wanted a say in the decision. AFGE President Everett Kelly said that, and I quote, "Changes like this should be negotiated with our bargaining units where appropriate," end quote. So far, 650,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, and vaccinations are needed. When 3,000 Americans died on September 11, 2001, citizens immediately let the government impose all sorts of airport mandates. And you can read the full story at CBS News. Melanie Lekasevic is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The Athens Town Board Tuesday, September 7th, deadlocked 2-2 on a vote that would have reversed a five-year-old decision to hand management of the Athens Community Center from the village to the town. One board member was absent and did not vote. The meeting drew a near-capacity crowd of village residents that generally opposed the change. Town Supervisor Robert Butler and board member Mary Brandau voted against the resolution, with board members Michael Regani and Shannon Spinner voting for it. Board member Anthony Pulch was not present. Butler said a second vote will be taken on September 20th when everyone will be present. He said, and I quote, "We'll have to do it again when our fifth member is here," end quote. The building that houses the Athens Community Center was the first but temporary home of Columbia Green Community College in 1969 before moving its campus to Greenport in 1974. For years, it has served as a community center, housing the town and village offices, as well as the town court, village police station, and a public gymnasium. The building is owned by the Coxsackie-Athens Central School District, but as long as it remains a community center under the current arrangement, the village is not responsible for it.
According to a letter from the village board to the community, and I quote, "Currently, the village maintains the community building and the town rents the space they use from the village. The building is in need of extensive renovation. Several years back, the town and village boards resolved to turn the building over to the town, which has the financial capability of performing the renovations," end quote. However, for a number of years, the town board has been considering moving the town offices to another location and constructing a new building, leaving the community center in the hands of the village. Village Mayor Amy Sarago said, and I quote, "From the village standpoint, obviously we want to move ahead with what was in place," end quote. She went on to say, and I quote, "When I first became a trustee, it was already past due to turn the building over. It was supposed to happen in late January 2019. I think the community is behind us sharing the building, rehabbing the building, making it what it could and should be," end quote. Sarago conceded the building needs a lot of repairs, but she said the two municipalities working together could handle it. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Leanne DeRosa is reporting for CBS 6 Albany. As students head back to school, social media timelines are being flooded with photos of children holding homemade posters that list their names, age, school, grade, teacher's name, interest, and more. Germantown Central School District School Resource Deputy Teddy Blank is warning parents to avoid the trend. Blank said, and I quote, "In the beginning, it seemed like a good idea. It's interactive. It gets a lot of likes and shares on the internet. But it also can get a lot of predators and people who are looking to benefit for themselves by using that simple information," end quote. He said concerns were raised with sharing information, not just from posting a student's photo. Blank strongly urges parents to avoid sharing details like name, date of birth, school information, or personal interest. He said to also make sure the photo does not show house numbers or street signs. Some of the details could lead to identity theft, password breaches, or in the worst case scenario, abduction or other safety concerns. Blank said, and I quote, "It could be used as a manipulation technique if a child is presented with those tidbits of information that could cause them to trust an unknown adult," end quote. Benjamin Yankson, an assistant professor at UAlbany's College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity, reminds parents to check the privacy policies and privacy settings on social media platforms. He said on some platforms, like Facebook, for example, if they still want to post pictures, they can choose who sees it. You can read the full story at CBS6Albany.com. Kate Lisa and Sam Rowdens are reporting for Johnson Newspaper Corp. that police have confirmed that attorney Kyle Vandewater, the former GOP 19th congressional district candidate, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Town of Poughkeepsie police found Vandewater, 41, of Hyde Park, unconscious around 12:30 p.m. September 7th in the Poughkeepsie Rural Cemetery on South Avenue. Police performed CPR and other measures in an attempt to save his life until emergency medical crews arrived. He was taken by ambulance to Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie, where he was pronounced dead later that day. Police failed to disclose further details. The matter remains under investigation by Poughkeepsie Police. U.S. Representative Antonio Delgado, Vandewater's opponent in the 2020 general election, expressed sadness about his death in a statement, and he shared resources for veterans in crisis. Delgado said, and I quote, "My heart breaks for Kyle and his beautiful family. We shared a number of conversations about family and country, and I walked away from each one knowing that he had a profound love for both. I know he will be immensely missed, and I am praying for all who loved him," end quote. A retired major in the U.S. Army, Vandewater went on active duty in 2006 and completed one tour in Afghanistan. He served as a judicial advocate in the Judge Advocate General's Corps. He leaves behind his wife, Melissa, and their four children, middle school-aged triplets, Thomas, Lincoln, and Annabella, and 8-year-old Levi. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXE Newsroom, I'm Philip Graham. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Lego Velt pays tribute to his prized synth with the title of his album, Crystal Cult 2080, and we'll hear his retro electronica on the next Deep Threes. Plus music from Makanuchi Bento, Bedrock, Anja, Black Heat, and Kevin Lyons. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next on the radio, WGXC's Randall Martin and the Reverend Kim Singletary speak with Don Kropf, the Democratic candidate for Columbia County Sheriff, running against incumbent Republican David Bartlett in this November's election.
All right, so, and you feel free to stay for the next part of our program, the next segment for our conversation with Ms. Jackie Salvatore and Mr. Don Kropf.
Absolutely.
Well-known individuals in the Columbia County City of Hudson community, and they are here to talk with us. And so I'm going to just allow them to give self-introduction. I think you're both, Jackie and Don, I think you're both on mute right now.
No, Don is free, and Jackie is free. Which one? Who wants to go first?
Oh, okay. My line is so mute. Sorry about that. All right.
I'll go first if Jackie's okay with that.
Absolutely.
All right. Kim, hey, Randall, how are you? Thank you for inviting us to the program today.
Very well. Thanks for coming.
It's good to have you here. And, you know, for people who don't know who Don Kropf is, in the 60-second self-intro, can you tell us?
Absolutely. So I was born and raised here in Columbia County in the town of Greenport. Spent a lot of time in the city of Hudson when I was younger, attending the Mark Carmel Church down there, very active in the church. I grew up here. So I took it upon myself to get into the academy, police academy in 1998, worked my way up to a division commander in the sheriff's office. All while trying to still give back to the community, doing community programs such as Cops for Kids, which we created to help provide services and Christmas toys and some monetary donations to Columbia Memorial Hospital. We put on benefits for folks whose houses burned down. Just a slew of different activities we've done throughout the years. And that leads me to where I am now, running for sheriff with the community need for change here within the law enforcement community. We need to rebuild the trust and have our sheriff's office be part of this community for which we serve. I mean, it's not the sheriff's office, the people's sheriff's office. And the elected official needs to understand that the people have a voice and they need to be heard.
Well, we're going to get into that a little deeper in a minute. Let's hear from Ms. Jackie, and would you please say hello to our listeners and give us a little introduction to who you are?
Hello, everybody, and thank you again for having us on. And my name is Jackie Salvatore, born and raised in Columbia County in the city of Hudson. Jackie Mason is my birth name. My parents moved here from Virginia the year I was born, so I've been here my whole life. I am a 28-year veteran of New York State Police. I retired 5 years ago as a detail commander in charge of the employee assistance program. Started out as every trooper does on the road down in Newburgh. Went to the Thruway for a year. I worked here in Claverick as a trooper and as an investigator, just prior to them moving to what is now the Livingston Station. I managed a construction business administratively for 20 plus years, worked at United Airlines, started by loading baggage in aircraft, then 2 years later was running the entire operation as a manager at Albany Airport. I currently manage an office for a literary agent, drive school bus part-time, love the kids. I do a few things here and there, but, Donnie's convincing me to come out of retirement and join this team is because, one, this is home base for me, and I love Columbia County. in the resonance and everything about it. But more importantly, we had a conversation, and I agree wholeheartedly with this platform, where we need to return or restore the trust in policing with transparency and accountability, and change the face of the agency to mirror the community it represents. But more importantly, so that it becomes an agency that attracts people rather than have people be afraid of policing.
Well, before we go back to Don, I just wish we were on television or you could see on Zoom, because Jackie just talked about three careers that she has had and 20 years at this and 28 years at that, and she only looks 40. I don't get it. Like, how did you do that? How did you do that? My God. Oh, my goodness. I'm in stitches right now. You yeah. know, I knew she had spent 28 years in the state troopers, and I'm like, oh, okay, that was her lifetime. And then she's talking about 20 years here and another dozen years there. And, yeah. you know, well, my snaps and claps to you, my sister. You look well, no worse for the wear.
Thank you.
Mr. Don, you don't look any worse for the wear either. I just met you a couple of weeks ago and we were having conversation, and actually I wanted, you know, to get to talking about what you got coming up this weekend, but we can't get there because the people really need to hear about your platform or your campaign, your agenda. Our station does give equal time. He is not running unopposed, and the station does give equal time. This is your time to shine, okay? Yes, tell us about, well, first of all, I'm just curious, maybe some of my listeners are there any particular moments that stood out to you in your career, as a sheriff, a deputy sheriff, a division commander, any particular moments that really stood out to you that had a life, changing impact or an inspiring, influence in you?
Absolutely, Reverend Kim. Throughout my 23 years at the sheriff's office, I had ample opportunity to talk with thousands of people throughout the community. And I think some of the most memorable times are when we interact with those in our mental health community. And, I think that we really need to focus on the fact that substance abuse and mental health are a major problem, and it's not a criminal problem. And, we interact with so many people every day, and sometimes incarceration and arrest is not the answer. So I mean, those are the things that really stand out to me, is the fact that it is a full community, and we need to respect our community as a whole and understand our community as a whole. And, I remember one instance where, we had a gentleman who we deal with quite often, throughout my career. And, bring him into the in for medical attention, and the medical professional is asking why he wasn't incarcerated. And, my answer is that mental health is not a crime, and this individual needed help. And we got him to where he needed to be, and we had all the correct documentation. And thankfully, the person was admitted and received the help he needed. But, that there's hundreds of examples through the couple decades I've been with the sheriff's office that we can go on and on, but that's probably one of the most telling incidents that I dealt with throughout my career.
I'm so glad that we had an opportunity to hear you say that and share that, because the conversations that I've had around the county with law enforcement, particularly in, reimagining community policing, some of what Jackie was talking about, that whole issue of how law enforcement responds when they get a call and it's really a mental health situation, not a criminal act, a situation. There is a kind of a fear in the community around some families that of calling law enforcement to help. That's the default reaction is when you have someone who is with a mental health issue and you can't get them to calm down, get controlled or whatever. And so you call the local law enforcement people, and then they show up and, you know, and they treat them like a criminal, or worst case scenario, they're injured or killed. So to hear you, you know, saying that that's the way that you've been dealing with the issue in terms of they need help, they don't need to be criminalized or vilified or even demonized, you know, that's important to communicate out there, that there are those viewpoints out there among our law enforcement, and certainly that is one that you hold and you bring to the table in your aspiration to lead as our county sheriff. So talk to us about, you know, what your campaign agenda is. What is your platform? Let's hear something about that.
Our platform is basically a community-centric platform, and it involves a lot of interaction with the community and listening to the community, reaching out to community leaders, you know, embedding the sheriff's office in the community as far as town hall meetings, you know, cultural meetings, religious meetings, and just reaching out to the people of Columbia County and finding out what they feel is important for their law enforcement and their community. To reestablish the resident deputy program. The resident deputy program initially started out with the sheriff's office to work with the community and to lessen the burden for the road patrol, to take over cases that initially started through the road patrol. And then these resident deputies would go out and meet with members of the community and the supervisors and the business owners and try to gather information and solve these crimes through community interaction. We want to reestablish that, but we also want to take it a step further and make all our deputies community deputies, resident deputies, deputies that know their community and reach out to their community on a daily basis. It's fine if you're sitting there running radar in your vehicle, but I think you're going to do a lot better if you can step out of your car for a few minutes here and there and speak with business owners and community members and, you know, find out what's going on in their neighborhood. You know, reaching out to the community is key. Also, to increase and to improve the training. I think, you know, we as police officers receive hundreds of hours of training a year, but we need to take something away from the training. Just saying that we're getting the training is not enough. We need to retain the information that's being presented to us. And in order to do that, I think we need to get back to bringing people in from outside the sheriff's office, experts in their field, individual fields, and to train us as police officers. You know, sitting in front of a computer, in front of a computer, and just listening to, you know, training, you know, is not enough. It's checking the box. We need to do better than that. We owe our community a lot more than just checking boxes. You know, those are a few of the things we're looking at. You know, we want to do smarter spending. We need to review our vendor services. You know, we can't continue to use the same vendors over and over and over again for decades. And when there's better products out there, better vendors out there, more economic vendors out there, and we need to review these things. And we need to review through data collected over the years, you know, decisions made through data. Not just decisions made through who we've been using for the past several decades.
Well, before, I appreciate that. I appreciate what you're saying. Before we go into talking about, you know, products and best practices and data-driven decision-making, because I think that's the conversation that people would want to understand. Also, I just want to go back to the resident deputy point. Because I grew up with, you know, Andy Griffith and, you know, and Mayberry, you know, and Andy, the folks in the town knew Andy, you know, and they knew, you know, I can't think of his name, but his assistant Barney, thank you. They knew Barney Fife, you know, and so that's what I envisioned. When you talk about resident deputy sheriffs being out there and knowing their community, is it somewhere in between there, close to there, or what? What are we talking about resident deputy, other than the title? Because I heard about the resident deputy for the first time over the spring when we were doing the police reimagining committees, okay? That's when I heard about resident deputies. And maybe they've been active, and I didn't know them in that title, but I asked other people, do they know who their resident deputy was? And they didn't. So is it like that? Like, you know, knowing like Andy, being known by the people in the community, people, and you knowing who they are in your community? And is it, are we too populous and too diverse for that to happen? Or do you vision something like that?
No, I don't think we're too diverse at all. I think we need to, you know, improve the diversity in our department and be more reflective of our community. And I think the community should know not only their resident deputy, but their sheriff, their undersheriff, their captains, lieutenants, everyone who serves them in administrative roles. I mean, I think they should know them all by, you know, at least by their title and their name, if not by going up and shaking their hand, saying, "Hey, Don, hey, Jackie, how are you? Glad to see you here at our event." But, you know, back to your question, the resident deputy was someone who he had all the powers of a normal deputy as a regular deputy. He was a regular deputy, he or she. And he was just, and forgive me for saying he, but that deputy was just tasked to two or three towns within the county to deal with that particular geographical area. And the deputy would reach out to the supervisors of that township or those townships, the businesses, the community leaders, attend events. And if you didn't know who your resident deputy was, then your resident deputy maybe wasn't providing the services that's required of the title of resident deputy. Our deputies really, truly want to get out there and help the public. There's no doubt in my mind. I've worked with 99% of the deputies that are on the road right now, and each and every one of them that I talk to are just eager to get out there and serve the public. You know, COVID was a big hit. We couldn't get out there and have much personal contact with individuals, getting out there and talking to them face to face. But now with the lowering of the COVID restrictions, I think it's time we get back out there and really embed ourselves in the community and cohesively work with other county entities in order to, you know, build stronger ties within our county.
Which is something that we're working on. Before you say that, Randall, I just want to say that, again, I wasn't familiar with the term resident deputies. I have had some interactions with some sheriffs and deputies. I always couldn't understand how come one is elected the sheriff and we call everybody else sheriff, but they're actually deputy sheriffs, okay? So the idea that the term gets more visibility and connected to faces and names, I think is, you know, really what I wanted to put out there. And snaps and claps to all of you all. We want to celebrate you all. Collectively, our essential workers who have helped us as communities sustain and have some normalcy going through this pandemic and post-pandemic.
WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA.
That's it.
Let's go.
WGXE is always looking for new programmers to volunteer at your community radio station. Email info@wgxe.org if you have all sorts of terrific music you want to share with your friends and neighbors, or if you want to join in the greater community conversation on the radio at 90.7 FM. Programmers learn how to do their own radio show and podcast, and how to make audio adventures interesting for listeners. You can call the WGXE Hudson studio at 518-697-7400 or email info@wgxe.org if you're interested in hosting a program or working with others on or off the air on WGXE.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Claire in Acre, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, September the 10th, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. As the nation marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks, Muslim groups are reflecting on progress in the treatment of American Muslims.
According to the Institute for Policy Studies, the war on terror in the aftermath of 9/11 created a culture that framed Muslims as suspects and taught them to fear the government. Amina Barhoumi with the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Ohio says 2 decades later, many prejudices linger.
Anti-Muslim discrimination still exists in policies. Secret watch lists still exist. Muslims are oftentimes spoken of from the framework of national security rather than being ordinary citizens that just want to live out their ordinary American lives.
Roughly 60% of American Muslims reported experiencing religious discrimination between 2016 and 2020. However, a recently released survey of American mosque leaders found that fewer than 1 in 5 felt that American society is hostile to Islam. There are 1.5 million more Muslims in the U.S. now than in 2007, who account for 1.1% of the overall U.S. population. Mary Sherman reporting.
Meantime, South Dakota is among the states that are in the process of updating social studies standards for public schools. It comes amid national conversation about 9/11 curriculum ahead of the 20th anniversary of the attacks.
On a broader scale, education researchers say incorporating more lesson plans about the attacks has been slow in most states. Cheryl Lynn Duckworth, a Florida-based professor who has written about the topic, says there are some barriers, including teachers needing to stick with what's required to keep test scores up.
The whole life of the school is testing and student scores. So if a subject like 9/11 is not embedded in the curriculum, and more often than not it isn't, it can be very, very difficult to carve out any kind of time.
Only 14 states have the subject as part of their required materials. The proposed update from the South Dakota Department of Education does mention 9/11 and events for high school students to learn about. The draft plan says officials want these grade levels to be more exposed to the more recent decades of U.S. history. I'm Mike Moen.
Public comment on the South Dakota proposed standards will begin on September the 20th with a hearing in Aberdeen. President Biden Thursday used the full force of his presidency to ensure 2/3 of the American workforce is vaccinated against the coronavirus. The New York Times reports that includes private sector employees, healthcare workers, and federal contractors. The Times notes the sweeping actions reflect Biden's deep frustration with the roughly 80 million Americans who are eligible for the shots but have not yet been vaccinated. This is PNS. And as the COVID-19 pandemic rages on, folks in Michigan concerned about the quality of their health care, according to new research.
A recent poll of about 600 Michigan voters finds nearly 80% agree that the amount they pay for health care seems to be going up every year. More than a quarter said they had overdue or unpaid medical bills they were struggling to pay off at the time of the survey. Pollster Bernie Porn of Epic MRA says the poll makes it clear that cost is the overarching concern when it comes to the state of the healthcare system.
It's not surprising that many Michigan voters are stressed out about the idea of going to a hospital or seeing a doctor. Out-of-pocket costs should not be so high or unpredictable that they discourage people from seeking care.
He says in addition to high premiums and high deductibles, 85% of Michigan voters are worried about what he calls junk insurance plans that provide too little coverage. The poll was conducted last month by ALG Research and Epic MRA on behalf of Consumers for Quality Care. I'm Lily Wolke reporting.
Arkansas is the only state in the nation with what's known as a failure to vacate statute. It criminalizes the failure to pay rent. And a federal case filed last week is challenging that law. Natasha Baker is with Equal Justice Under Law.
There is no reason to have a law that criminalizes poverty. There is no reason to be arresting and jailing people for not paying rent when there is a civil landlord-tenant court system that is designed to resolve landlord-tenant disputes.
Baker says the goal is to put an end to a law that scares residents into what she calls self-eviction. Arkansas doesn't legally require landlords to provide a habitable place to live. Finally, Pennsylvania, now the second state in the country to launch a program focused on training state and local leaders on tackling the challenges of climate change.
The Pennsylvania Climate Leadership Academy, run by the State Department of Environmental Protection, wrapped up the first portion of the program this week. About 170 people from nonprofits, state agencies, local governments, and universities participated in the online courses that discussed the impacts of climate change on communities and policy-driven solutions to mitigate its effects. DEP's Heidi Kunch says civic engagement is key to addressing environmental concerns.
It's not about doom and gloom. It's about taking action and all hands on deck, all of us, down to the homeowner, making changes in our own homes with the way we use energy and with the way we commute. It starts with each of us. Every one of us has a role to play.
Maryland was the first state in the U.S. to launch its Climate Leadership Academy. I'm Emily Scott.
Pennsylvania's average temperature has risen nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900. This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service, member and listener supported, heard on interesting radio stations. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that an organization representing landlords in New York on September 9th moved to begin a legal challenge to New York's eviction moratorium. They claim the legislature's extension of New York's moratorium on pandemic-related evictions to January 15th conflicts with a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. The Rent Stabilization Association previously were successful challenging a provision of the moratorium in federal court. The eviction moratorium is for those with a financial hardship related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Landlords say they still must pay property taxes and other utility costs, but without rental income, they also have a financial hardship. Rent Stabilization Association Executive Director Joseph Strasberg said, and I quote, "No matter the spin by state lawmakers and Governor Hochul, this is a re-implementation of the previous law, completely disregarding last month's U.S. Supreme Court decision and ignoring key elements of our complaint. It continues the vague COVID hardship declaration, which enables renters who never lost their job or skipped a paycheck to continue using the eviction ban as a moratorium on paying rent," end quote. State officials have been slowly doling out some of the $2.1 billion emergency rental assistance program to landlords. New Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin on September 9th said distribution of the rental assistance funding would be one of his top priorities. And you can read about this story at New York State of Politics. Sam Rowdens reports for Columbia Green Media that a zoning amendment proposed that would allow a few eating and drinking establishments in a residential part of Hudson may not be needed. On September 8th, the Hudson Common Council Legal Committee found that a 2018 Hudson law could be applied to the area west of 3rd Street where officials want to allow restaurants. But this current law only allows for buildings used for commercial purposes to petition the planning board to use a space for, and I quote, "eating and drinking places," end quote. Hudson City Attorney Jeff Baker said, and I quote, "We can take the language and probably make some changes to it and have it apply to the R4 also," end quote. Common Council President Thomas DiPietro said the city, with a housing crisis, doesn't want to lose residential spaces. In August, First Ward Alderperson Jane Trombley said having establishments in a residential zone would be a, and I quote, degradation, end quote, but was now happy that this older law would not allow existing residents to be converted. The Common Council's next formal meeting is September 21st, and WGXC.org has a live web stream. Editor's note, DiPietro is a volunteer WGXC programmer. And you can read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Soup that the town of Durham made no progress this week on the contentious Bosque subdivision in Cornville as officials wait for additional information before continuing with the State Environmental Quality Review Act Environmental Assessment Form review. The proposed Bosque subdivision would put 12 high-end homes and a farming operation on 95 acres that border Strong Road and Cornwallville Road in the Greene County hamlet. Durham does not have a planning board, so the town board handles building proposals, and the next Durham town board meeting is at 7:30 p.m. September 21st at 7309 State Route 81. And you can read more about this story at Porcupine Soup. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
All summer, there are tours at the Hudson Athens Lighthouse every second Saturday of the month through October. You can visit the 1874 lighthouse that's in the middle of the Hudson River. The tours leaving from the Henry Hudson Riverfront Park in Hudson at 11 a.m., noon, 1 p.m., and 2 p.m., and from the Athens Village Riverfront Park at 11:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., 1:30 p.m., and 2:30 p.m. That's the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Tours all summer on the second Saturday. And you can find out more on the WGXC Community Calendar online at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Kravitz and Son Roofing, a local family-owned and operated full-service roofing company for more than 48 years. Specializing in residential and commercial roof construction, repair, maintenance, and replacement using high-quality and affordable roofing products. Information at 518-567-4026 or online at KravitzandSonRoofing.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Phoenix Grace of Del Mar, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're all working together to get the virus under control, to return to our normal lives.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says President Joe Biden will announce six new steps in the COVID response today.
Some of that will be related to access to testing. Some will be related to mandates. Some will be related to how we ensure kids are protected in schools.
New cases are approaching 150,000 per day. And ICUs are at more than 90% capacity in seven states. Republican Congressman Greg Murphy, who is also a doctor, visited a hospital in his North Carolina district where he says 90% of COVID patients on breathing tubes are unvaccinated.
The sicker people oftentimes have those comorbidities, the obesity, the diabetes mellitus, the kidney disease. However, it can occur in 25-year-olds who are stone cold healthy.
Meanwhile, Republicans Marjorie Taylor Greene and Chip Roy have been fined for not wearing masks on the House floor. Some conservative members of Congress resist mandatory COVID-19 prevention measures. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warns the U.S. will run out of cash in October unless Congress raises the debt limit. Senate Republicans, including John Thune of South Dakota, aren't interested.
I don't think there's a single Republican senator who views increasing the debt limit so that Democrats can expand government and spend massive amounts of money as something that they, in the end, would want to support.
Democrats plan to pursue a bipartisan vote to waive the debt limit. A progressive group launched a $1.5 million campaign to build support to expand the U.S. Supreme Court from 9 seats to 13. Calls for a more balanced court have grown, especially after Senate Republicans rushed to fill Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat just weeks before the 2020 election. Democrats were outraged then, and also after Senate Republicans denied a Supreme Court seat to President Barack Obama's nominee in 2016, current Attorney General Merrick Garland. Election workers who face intimidation have a new outlet for assistance. The Election Official Legal Defense Network will provide free legal aid to officials from any jurisdiction. In Harris County, Texas, Chief Deputy Clerk Michael Wynn says he witnessed several attempts to cause conflict at the polls in November.
In the quest for transparency, there were those who saw an opportunity to create falsehoods that tried to undermine the elections process in Harris County.
Nearly one in three local election officials surveyed said they feel unsafe in their jobs. Vice President Kamala Harris stumped in California for Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom, who is facing a recall election next week. Harris says there's more at stake than just the future of the Golden State.
What's happening around our country with these policies that are about attacking women's rights, reproductive rights, voting rights, workers' rights. They think if they can win in California, they can do this anywhere.
Opponents attack Newsom's response to the pandemic, extreme weather, and the state's homelessness and housing crisis. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Hello, I'm Daniel Smith, an instructor of humanities at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences.
As an instructor at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, one of the courses that you teach is History of Public Health and Medicine. How can history help us to understand COVID-19?
Mark Twain said, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes." I see aspects of the response to the COVID-19 pandemic that are very similar to events in the past. One example of this is the terrible rise in anti-Asian hate and violence. In many previous epidemics, minority groups have been scapegoated and attacked. One famous example is the persecution that European Jews suffered during the bubonic plague pandemic in the 14th century. If one examines many of the more recent epidemics in 19th century America, there are always prominent voices blaming immigrants for the spread of disease. I just read an article about an outbreak of yellow fever in New Orleans in 1853, and Irish and German immigrants were blamed. It is sad to see that humanity has not moved past this. Take another example. Opposition to vaccination is unfortunately not new. There were prominent anti-vaccination movements in the US dating back to the 19th century. In 1905, in Jacobson v. Massachusetts, the Supreme Court ruled that a state may mandate vaccinations during a pandemic and levy fines or other punishments on individuals who refuse to be vaccinated. However, the court held that the state may not forcibly vaccinate anyone against their will.
Now we have the Delta virus, and unfortunately much of your family has gotten breakthrough COVID-19 infections, meaning the adults in your family who are all fully vaccinated still contracted the virus. Could you talk a little bit about what your family has been going through?
Yes, thank you. So 4 fully vaccinated members of my family have suffered breakthrough infections of COVID-19. My wife and myself and my in-laws have all tested positive for COVID-19 in August. We all experienced symptoms such as persistent fever, cough, sore throat, body aches. My wife, my father-in-law, and I were ill for about a week to 10 days. It wasn't, you know, terrible. I suppose you might describe it as mild, moderate symptoms. Unfortunately, my mother-in-law has had a much more difficult time. She has a lot of pre-existing health conditions, and she had to be hospitalized. She was on high-flow oxygen and steroids. And for a time, the doctors expressed pessimism about her prospects for recovery. Fortunately, her condition has improved and she'll be going to a rehabilitation facility soon. It's been difficult for all of us. My wife has not been able to visit her mother, for example, in the hospital until she tested negative.
Thank you for sharing. The New York Times on Tuesday sent in their the morning email that people have exaggerated fears about the breakthrough infections. What is your response to the article that we have less than 1 in 5,000 chance of getting COVID as a vaccinated person?
I don't have any, data on the issue, so I can't really dispute the findings of the report in the New York Times. However, I do think it's interesting and noteworthy that four members of my family who were fully vaccinated with mRNA vaccines all contracted COVID-19 and experienced illness. We were not all vaccinated at the same time, so it can't just be, a batch of vaccine was ineffective. My wife and I were vaccinated with two doses of the Pfizer vaccine in January, February. My in-laws, though, were vaccinated with two doses of the Moderna vaccine in February, March. So different times of vaccination, and we all tested positive. It seems, odd that would be the case if the infections are so rare. I don't know how I or my family members contracted COVID-19. We had been following, guidance. We'd been continuing to mask indoors. We had, been out in public more than we were when the pandemic first started. We did take a short trip to central Massachusetts. We have been to restaurants and things of that nature. So it's possible that, we may have contracted COVID-19, from these, public outings that we had avoided before we were vaccinated. But we don't really know for certain.
As somebody who teaches at ACPHS, and as somebody who's had the breakthrough case of COVID, what do you think is important for our listeners to understand about COVID safety?
I think it's very important for people to continue to be vaccinated. I want to encourage people to be vaccinated who haven't been yet. It's very possible that the outcome of my illness and my family's illness would have been much worse if we had been unvaccinated. All of the data seems to suggest that. Also, I would encourage everyone to follow the CDC's recommendations regarding booster shots if they become approved. So our infections had taken place several months after we were fully vaccinated. So perhaps it's anecdotal, but perhaps that's an indication that boosters may be necessary. Finally, even if you are fully vaccinated, I would encourage people to take precautions such as masking when indoors, avoiding large crowds, et cetera.
Looking at the history of pandemics and the othering of certain communities, how do we overcome these separations of communities? It feels like it's very divisive currently. Is there anything in our history that can tell us a way that we can move forward from this moment in a less divisive way?
There is some interesting historical literature about periods of time when the nation has come together to combat infectious disease. One example is shortly after World War II, there was fear of an outbreak of smallpox in New York City. And the city government encouraged everyone to get vaccinated for smallpox. And the public was very compliant. The public overwhelmingly received vaccinations, and they prevented an epidemic from breaking out. The scholars have argued why the public was so compliant at this time. It wasn't a mandate. They didn't require people to get vaccinated. And the leading suggestion seems to be that Americans had experienced regimentation during the war. Americans were used to following government orders like blackouts. And so the public was sort of used to following these sorts of directives. And I mean, you saw that with the polio vaccine as well. Overwhelmingly, people received it without much controversy. I wonder if that's just that sort of brief interlude in the post-war period, 40s and 50s, where the public had become, accustomed to following government leadership.
And you now headed back into the classroom to teach. What do you feel are necessary precautions we need to take when making learning a healthy environment and to protect all students and staff?
Yes, I'm teaching several in-person courses. I do feel safe returning to the classroom because my college has taken a number of corrective measures. ACPHS is requiring that all community